All right, hello everybody, and we are back live at WHPC, Friday, 5 p.m. I say live in case you are listening to this live. We are just back from our winter vacation break, and this is our first show after a nice holiday vacation break. Nice in one sense. I mean, we came back, Heidi had a cold, and we were talking about that on Wednesday.
I'm still a little bunged up.
You sound pretty good, though. You sound a lot better, and I was talking about it on Wednesday, and now I'm the one who has got to be careful. So
I finally gave you my funk.
I'll apologize in advance in case we're coughing on mic. But that being said, we had left off, of course, doing our series on Louis Armstrong. And this is our ninth show dedicated to Louis. And we pick up with our ninth episode, actually, right in the middle of the Depression. The year is 1931, where we pick up. This is a time when you could refer to, I suppose, as Louis's classic era, insofar as it covers the time period when he pretty much rises to become, at least arguably, the single most famous musician in American history at this time. And he's doing this in America, all in the midst of an atmosphere which is, there's rampant racism, period, just flat out. In the 30s, forget it. It was incredibly difficult. Prohibition laws are still in place, which means that the gangsters that come with prohibition are in full, you know.
This is Gatling guns on the street.
Exactly. And also the worst economic depression that the country had ever witnessed. Louis could have seen his career derailed in just about any one of 100 different ways. Yet, due to his talent, obviously, and also his indomitable goodwill, couldn't keep a good man down, he continued to thrive. By now, his musical innovations had become commonplace among musicians. If you couldn't play like Louis, then you weren't hip. You couldn't swing. You just weren't going to be able to get even a record contract, because this is what the world demanded at this point. Louis was the man. As a result of all this, Louis just simply settled into being himself. You know, the music at this point may have been only slightly less innovative than it had been in the beginning, because he was changing the world. Now he's like settling in to his comfort zone. So at this point, still everything that he touches turns into musical gold. And if I may pick up where we had left off, I think we had mentioned that he had problems with being arrested in California.
Oh, yeah, the parking lot incident.
Yeah, and there was this manager thing going back and forth where he had like a new manager who showed up to help get him out of prison. And all of a sudden,
and then didn't want to go.
He becomes his manager, in a sense, Johnny Collins. And all of a sudden, what Louis didn't know was that his manager in New York, Tommy Rockwell, really didn't have much to do with it. And Johnny Collins managed to pretty much hijack Johnny Collins' management arrangement with Louis. That wasn't going down too well. But Louis ends up going back to Chicago. And Johnny Collins, acting as his manager, does a great job, gets him a job in Chicago working at the Regal Theater. Louis is regrouped with many of his New Orleans comrades and formed another big band in Chicago. Again, Louis didn't want to lead the band, although he was the star. So he asks the second trumpeter, Zillner Randolph, to act as the leader, which he's happy to do, although there's resentment among the other band members. Oh, he thinks he's a big guy. You know, Louis was cool with it. Louis wanted it that way. That's the way it had to go down. Again, this is another band that was subject to some criticism at the time, because everybody thought that Louis, being the invention of hot, the guy who invented it, should have continued to play hot all the time. But every now and then, this band liked to play sweet. However, Louis, being who he was, on top of it, there's only so... You're only going to get so sweet, no matter how you cut it. And it wouldn't be long also before trouble would start again for Louis. And this song might imply some of that. Here's Louis from that era in 1931 with a track called Blue Again. ¶¶
again, blue again, and you know darn well it's you again. You said last night we were through again, and now I'm blue again. I'm alone again, alone again. I'm out around on my own again, 'cause the mocking voice has flown again, and I'm alone again. Now, baby, though I said I hate you, I love you more every day, babe. Though I aggravate you, honest, I'm dying to say that it's new again, you again. And we'll meet today at 2:30 again, and tonight we'll fight again, and I'll be blue again.
You know one thing? I sure be glad when you're dead. You ain't no good at all. You're snooping around my house and laughing and grinning in my face and trying to bite me in the back of my wife, you dog, you.
Now, I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. Boy, I brought you into my home. You wouldn't leave my wife alone. I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. Boy, I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. I'll be tickled to death when you leave this earth, you dog. And I took you for my friend. The way you bit me in the back was a sin. You ain't no good, you rascal, you. Oh, I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. I will be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. When you're laid 6 feet deep, no more fried chicken will you eat. Oh, you dog, you rascal, you. Ah. Oh, you dog. Yes, sir. You ain't no good, that dog. You just ain't no good. As I said before, I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. I'll be standing on a corner high when they bring your body by. Oh, you dog, you rascal. I will be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. Boy, what is it that you've got that makes my wife think you hot? Oh, you dog, oh, you dog. Hey. Ah. Yes, sir. Boy, what make you so no good? You come to my house and eat up all my victuals. You know what I mean, that's something to eat. Ah.
two perfectly representative songs of what Lewis sounded like at this time. Perfect in the sense that the band, I think, is doing a more than adequate job. They really didn't deserve to be criticized. The problem was that their people were, I guess, after the Hot Five and the Hot Seven recordings and everything that they had brought as far as innovation, people were having a hard time accepting the fact that this band played like an ordinary band. But you put Lewis on top of it, you end up with anything but an ordinary band.
Right.
And you can just hear the spirit that Lewis brings to those two tracks with his vocal delivery and just the sheer joy that comes out of his horn and his voice basically takes it and transcends any of that.
But people always complain about any musician when they have a stylistic change.
Yes.
That's
and that, or
just
even
the nature of the beast.
As the times change, like, oh, and he's not keeping up with it. You're always doomed to some sort of criticism. And Lewis was at that
point. The old stuff.
When you're at the top of his, you know, when you're that famous and you're number, basically, you're number one, you're it. There's always someone who's going to try to cut you. To come underneath you and change things.
And don't you know about being cut?
Any good musician probably does, and maybe especially bad ones. But nevertheless, I mean, like I said, this is Lewis pretty much enjoying his popularity. And it was an amazing thing, too, because, again, this is the Depression. Listen to this statistic. Recording sales of single of 78 RPM records in 1921. They sold $106 million worth of 78 RPM records in 1921. $106 million. By 1931, 10 years later, the number didn't go up. It went down to $17 million for the entire year, for the entire business.
Oh, because of the Depression.
Yeah.
People just didn't have the extra money.
It was virtually 10% of what it had been 20 years ago when it was just beginning to, when it was a new industry. Fairly incredible. Lewis averted disaster, mostly, of course, through his talent, but also by taking some advice from his original manager, Tommy Rockwell, who told Lewis that he should record popular songs because the audience likes popular songs. You'll find that you'll cross over. You'll appeal to a broader audience. So Lewis stuck to songs that he knew would actually appeal not only to, like, say, the R&B market, which wasn't really the R&B market. At the time, they called it the race market, but would cross over to pretty much anybody. So, and that's what Lewis decided to do, and it worked brilliantly. He allowed the recordings to focus on his vocals, too, because either you got it or you didn't get it. And if you didn't get it, you thought it was a novelty. So you got it in that regard. Lewis wasn't trying to be a novelty, though. He was just, this is him. So it didn't matter how you heard it. What mattered is that you were attracted to it.
And you bought it.
And you bought it. And it kept him alive at a time when everybody else was suffering. And it was that loose playful.
He was no stranger to suffering either.
Definitely not.
All his life he struggled.
Exactly, where he came from. So this is a guy who pretty much, he was smart enough to maintain that loose playful style that appealed to his audiences. And he probably couldn't have lost it even if he wanted it, even if he wanted to. And these next two songs, I think, do a great job of conveying the brilliance of how well he can handle classics and make them totally his own. We'll hear two tracks back to back. First up is Lazy River, and then we're going to hear his phenomenally classic version of the song Stardust.
Up the lazy river where the robin song wakes to bright new morning as we loaf along. Blue skies up above, everyone in love. Up the lazy river, how happy we will be. Mama, mama. Oh, up the lazy river, up the lazy river, Every day, little bit, but it'll be hard. and the lady be dead, my long now. By the judge, you did, but didn't,
Oh, you dog. Boy, if I ain't ripping this evening, I hope something.
Oh, lady of the lazy river. River. Oh, you river.
Oh, you dog.
Oh, you river.
Look out there, Charles Alexander. Swing out there on him, Iris, that boy.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend such lonely nights. Oh, baby, lonely nights. Dreaming of a song, melody, memory. And I'm once again with you.
When our love was new, oh, man. Each kiss an inspiration.
Now that, baby, you know. And you are in my arms, baby. The nightingale tells its fairy tale of paradise
where roses bloom. Though I dream in vain, in my heart
it will remain, baby. My stardust melody.
those two songs would have to fight anybody's argument about what the quality of Lewis's material was like at this time, because those are two of the most phenomenally integral recordings I've ever heard, quite honestly. Even Lewis is impressed. If you were listening on Lazy River when he does his scat vocal, he gets so impressed with himself at one point that he actually stops and he goes, "Oh, you dog, boy, am I riffing this evening." And it's just great to hear him enjoying himself that much. And the other track, Stardust, which I just finished, is, in my opinion, probably one of the most beautiful melodies ever written. But in Lewis's hands, that song, it's all about Lewis. He sticks, you know, he allows his trumpet to flirt with the melody quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But when he sings it, he's not worried about the melody at all. He almost flatlines it on a note because it's about his personalities more than anything. And another thing I can't play them back to back because it would be redundant, but he recorded three versions of this song at the same recording session. And they all eventually did see the light of day. And they're very telling if you did play them back to back, because it really only goes to show just how instinctive his genius was. Each take, he sings it completely differently. His phrasing on his trumpet solo is completely different. It just shows that what he was really doing was instinctive. He wasn't going in there with parts and ideas that he had constructed. He was just really, what he, like you said, he was riffing.
Well, and you know, he's a true artist in that maybe he says, you know what, let me try it this way. And it's constantly changing and morphing.
Exactly. And he would do it from one take to the next. It wasn't like he was trying to say, oh, I almost had it, let me do that same thing again better. No, he just would move on to a whole new idea. And if you heard all three versions of Stardust, which are all brilliant, we just heard that one that we just played was my absolute favorite of the three, but they're all brilliant. And like I said, they're telling in comparison. Well, let's see what else. Well, there's another track. Since we're talking about Lewis and his style, and especially his singing, I think no song does a better job of like conveying that loose, playful thing that he's up to than this track, which is called Lonesome Road. It's a song where, first of all, he doesn't perform the song at all. Lonesome Road, pretty much, you hear the band trying to play the song.
Uh-huh.
But Lewis just goes off, and he never comes back to the song. He just starts to perform this, like, this spiel of his, and he's just it turns into something almost like a vaudeville skit.
Oh, that's
it's that incredible. Don't now just because he got busted for getting high,
when he didn't stop.
He doesn't mean he stopped. No, he would go in and he would still get good and high. He'd try to get his entire band good
probably,
and high.
He was probably wasted on this take.
Yeah, exactly. You think I was right. So he'd probably come in and do this, and just the whole band would riff on the song with. And Lewis had no regard whatsoever to toning down his own natural inclination, and you can just tell that all over this track. Check out this song called "Lonesome Road."
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a little novelty here for you this evening. We'll have a little argument between the saxophone and the trumpet. Of course, these cats just told me they're going to get away. And the little trumpet just said it's going to do the same. Ain't that right, little trumpet? Say yes, sir. Oh, that little devil. But before we riff, we're going to chirp a few for you this time. So get your chops together, boys. While we mug lightly, and politely.
Chinatown, my Chinatown, where the lights are low. Oh, my Chinatown, drifting to and fro. Chinatown, my Chinatown, Chinatown, Chinatown.
Oh, you rapper, you.
Chinatown, open my Chinatown.
Look out there, saxophones. What's the matter with you? Let's go. Them cats getting away. Look like they're after me. Look at y'all. But I'm ready. I'm ready. So help me. I'm ready. Look out here. Thank you.
sisters and brothers. This is Reverend Satchel Mouth Armstrong. Gonna speak to you this evening, and I ain't gonna keep you here long. I just want to introduce some of the brothers. We have a little Creole member here, or rather, a new deacon. He want to say something to this congregation. He's none other than the Creole boy, Little Satchel Mouth Joe Lindsay. Say something from Joe, will you?
Now, sisters and brothers, we want to pick up a good collection here tonight for Brother Armstrong. Come on with it if you're coming. Oh, you dog.
And if you ever get it, Brother Lindsay, please don't put it in your pocket, will you? Thank you.
Amen.
Drop it in there, Brother Jack Randall. I thank you. Now, how to do, Brother Preston? And Brother Randall? Well, here's the three Sax boys. Little George James, Al Washington, and Lester Boone. Why, there's Charlie Alexander here, and Reverend Johnny Lindsay. And Deacon Hall. Why, here's two little songwriters here. Little Louis Dunlap and Charles Carpenter. And what do you think about that? They're smoking a Louis Armstrong special cigar. More power to you, boys. Hello, Professor Sherman Cook. How are you, brother? He's looking all prosperous. He's a New Orleans boy, so. Swing on, Brother Washington. Have you anything to say, Brother Mike McKendrick?
Nothing.
Well, thank you. Yes, Randall. What do you say, Randall?
Brother Armstrong, I haven't got my dollar money yet.
You better go home. Hello there.
I'm true.
Oh, my goodness. What kind of church is this? I got to get some of this for him. I got to take one of these curses. Give me some of this.
Swing it, Brother Armstrong.
Thank you for your little offering. Of course, it could have been better. $2 more would have got my shoes out of pawn. But nevertheless, I'm in love with you. Hold that, sister. But get off of my foot.
Oh, Brother Armstrong,
now,
you're killing me.
Look down. You're on the Dawson Road. Look down, that's not the road. Look down, that Dawson Road.
That is about as loose and as cool of a performance as you're likely to hear from any decade, really. But coming from 1931, it's stunning to hear.
They were out
there.
That was some reefer madness.
Right. And you can even tell, like, the band was probably shocked that Lewis was basically kind of passing around the mic, in a sense, getting everybody involved in the show in a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Well, it seemed like all the characters were in the house.
But he's so on, and he's so witty. And you can tell that even the band was like they would say, he'd give him the mic, and be like, you got anything to say? Nothing. And the guy's like, oh, Lewis, Mr. Armstrong, Brother Armstrong, you're killing me. it's unbelievable. It's great. It's fantastic. I had forgotten to mention, by the way, that I was preceding that track with another song from almost the exact same era called Chinatown, My Chinatown, which also had Lewis riffing.
Yes, and which throughout. He also comments in the track about his pleasure with himself of his ability to riff
exactly.
So well.
Again, which I can't blame him one bit.
Oh, you rascal.
The other funny thing that's kind of, he mentions that one of the guys, when he's talking to one of the band members in the room, he says, there he is smoking a Louis Armstrong special. And that's true. Louis Armstrong was so famous that one of the tobacco companies had actually rolled a cigar and sold it as a Louis Armstrong special. And Louis was really proud of that, the fact that he had his own a cigar named after him.
I thought he was talking about his
own something else. No.
Special blend.
Yeah, you'd think, but that wasn't the case. It really was
a cigar
that was named after him.
Interesting.
So anyway, that being all said, now we got to get into like the aspect of what his business life was like around this time. Collins his manager, had booked Louis Armstrong at this point. Everybody's calling him Louis. This is Louis's quote. I don't know why, but all the white folks call me Louis. It's really true. For some reason, he went from Louis to Louis because the white people who were hearing him suddenly just referred to him that way. And no, Louis doesn't know why. Nobody really knows why. Just a case.
People just like to feel familiar with somebody.
Yeah, and that's what happened. So
Louis, my mother, she was Victoria. No one ever called her anything but that. But when she moved to New Orleans, all of a sudden she became Vicky.
Yep, Vicky. So Louis became Louis because everybody felt like they knew him.
I guess exactly.
It was a term
that's
of endearment.
It's a term of endearment.
So anyway, he gets he has a job now in a bookie joint on the white side of Chicago, a place called Showboat, and it wasn't long before the gangsters started to lean on Louis. Now, this is the way that the story goes down, according to a book called Louis Armstrong, An Extravagant Life, written by Lawrence Burgreen. Let's see. As soon as he started the Showboat engagement, Louis received threats and demands for money. When he ignored them, he was approached by two local hoodlums, Joe Fiore and Emmett Ryan, who demanded he pay $6,000 or they would take him for a ride.
Uh-oh, a one-way ride.
As everyone in Chicago knew, that meant they would murder him. Well, Louis shrugged off the threats and continued to blow. The pair of extortionists decided the price they had placed on Louis's life was too steep, so they lowered it to $5,000. Louis continued to ignore them. With comical ineptitude, they lowered it again to $4,000. Louis continued to play. $3,000, more playing. Two, still no dice. By the time Fiore and Ryan dropped their price to $1,000, Louis ceased to even pay attention to them, and the pair of them were soon arrested, along with the man who put them up to the job, a music publisher named Milton Weil, who was part owner of a rival nightclub. The story made the Chicago dailies. Jail musician for blackmail of Armstrong, proclaimed one, describing Louis as the world-famous cornetist and orchestra leader. Another speculated on Weil's motive for trying to shake down such a popular figure. By way of explanation, Weil said he was, quote, only trying to get him to change managers. Oh, so maybe this was involved with the Tommy Rockwell thing.
Perhaps.
This remark suggested that the culprit was a manager with a real grievance against Louis Armstrong, a manager who felt the trumpet player had perhaps double-crossed him, a manager like Tommy Rockwell. Perhaps. Here's best explains the situation, but Louis found himself in. Here's a track called Between the Devil and the Deep Blue Sea.
Thank you.
Between the Devil and the Deep Blue Sea, exactly where Lewis caught himself at this stage of his career, at this point in time, with mobsters coming at him from both sides.
He was used to that kind of lifestyle.
He kind of was.
That's why he managed to ignore it.
He lived with whores and bookies and pimps, and he knew what the game was about, so that's why he wasn't putting up with none of it. On a musical note, I mean, that's what's amazing. It hit the breath control on that track that we just played is stunning. But, you know, it would be comical if the story that I just told had been the end of it. But that's not the case. The story goes on. I'll continue to read a little bit further on in the book. Lewis actually finds himself at the wrong end of a gun.
Oh, boy.
At this point. Because by this time, he had his big pistol, pulling it out as he said, "My name is Frankie Foster." And he said he was sent over to my place to see that I catch the first train out to New York.
That's nice.
I still tried to make it appear that he ain't frightening me. I said, "New York? Why, that's news to me. Mr. Collins didn't tell me anything about it," meaning his new manager. Frankie Foster said, "You're a bad sumbitch. Oh, yes, you're going to New York to work at Connie's Inn, and you're leaving tomorrow morning." And he flashed his big old pistol and aimed it straight at me with my eyes as big as saucers and frightened, too. I said, "Well, maybe I am going to New York." Then Frankie said, "Okay, now you and me are going to the telephone booth, and you'll talk. By this time, anything he ordered me was all right, because it's no trouble at all for a gangster to pull the trigger, especially when they have you cornered and you disobey them. So we went to the phone with a gun in my side, and sure enough, someone said hello. A familiar voice, too. Yes, sir, I'd know that voice if I'd heard it 100 years from now." However, to the end of his days, Lewis never revealed who that person was. But he was, in all likelihood, somebody who was connected to Dutch Schultz, the New York homicidal maniac mobster. Yeah. The first words he said to me, "What are you going to open? When are you going to open here?" I turned around and looked directly into Frankie Foster's face, the man holding the gun, and said, "Tomorrow morning." So Lewis is in deep now. It doesn't get much deeper than that.
Youch.
Man's in trouble. However, what ends up happening is he actually... The whole mob situation has the exact opposite effect that they intended to have on Lewis. He's not going to let them push him around. So two things happen. First, he tells his new manager, Tommy Rockwell, to cut all ties to his original manager, Tommy Rockwell. So now he's got Collins and only Collins to listen to. Second, now because he's relying on Johnny Collins to handle all the problems, he asks him to keep me out of harm's way, cancel all my showboat bookings here in Chicago, get me out of Chicago. And Collins immediately sent Lewis out and his band out of Chicago, where they went on an impromptu tour of one-night stands, trying to constantly stay one step ahead of the mob that was trying to follow them.
Nice.
So they literally were zigzagging from Baltimore to Detroit to Milwaukee to Minnesota.
It's a lot of driving.
For the rest of the year, a lot of driving, just trying to hide out. This is Lewis's own words about what it was like on that tour. He remembered, this is actually his recollection from playing in Baltimore during the Depression. "We arrived in the town and it was as cold as a well digger's you know what. Freezing. Well, I heard about these people who were too poor to get coal to keep themselves and their kids warm. So I went to the coal yard, ordered a ton of coal, and had the company deliver it to the lobby of the Royal Theater. Then I had all the folks who needed coal to help themselves. It made them very happy. And they made it their business to come backstage and thank me. Of course, it caused me to stick up my chest with pride. I came up through life the hard way, just like these folks."
Mm-hmm.
That's Lewis for you. Let's play one more track from around this time. Another song that dates from this same year. This is a song called "All of Me."
Take all of me, baby. Oh, can't you see?
no good without you. Oh, me better dig limbs. I want to lose them. Oh, baby, take my arms. I'll never use them. Oh, baby, your goodbye left me with eyes that cry.
Right, all of me, of course. We're playing the music of Louis Armstrong, and there's really just nothing but classics, it seems. They just keep rolling. Now, Heidi, the most amazing thing about this thing with Louis basically dodging the mob and going from town to town,
right,
is that it ended up bringing him back in the summer of 1932. He ends up back in New Orleans for the first time since he had left, that
ages
very first
ages.
Time when he got the phone call, which is pretty much where our very first show on Louis ended.
Right.
When he was leaving New Orleans. Well, it took all this time, and now he's suddenly finding himself going back to New Orleans, which had its ups and downs. The good side, I'll tell you about that first. Again, I'm just relying on this book because there's so much wonderful stories here. Let's see. The pressures on the mob could apply against him, whether directly or through Frankie Foster, extended all the way from Chicago to New York. He knew it was hopeless to stand up to the likes of Capone or Dutch Schultz or Oney Madden. If he wanted to blow on their turf, he had to do so on their terms. New Orleans, however, offered a temporary respite from these concerns, and he hoped an opportunity to consolidate his position as the Trumpet King on his own turf. Louis returns to New Orleans, and as he gets off of the train, to his eye, nothing had changed. These are his words now. We reached New Orleans early in June, and the last of the magnolias was still on the trees, the smell of them still in the air.
That's nice.
He wrote of his return. He wondered if he'd been forgotten during his absence, but when our train pulled into the old L&N station out by the Mississippi at the head of Canal Street, the same terminal from which he had departed with his fish sandwich years before, I had heard hot music playing. I looked out the car window and could hardly believe what I saw. There, stretched out along the track, were eight bands, all swinging together.
Wow.
As soon as I got off the train, the crowd went crazy. They picked me up on their shoulders and started a parade down the center of Canal Street. Those eight bands almost bust the town open. They made so much noise.
Wow.
His sister, Mama Lucy, was there to greet him. A brief hush fell over the crowd as Johnny Collins came forward, guiding Alpha by the arm, a white man escorting a black woman. But the moment passed, and Louis got into an open car at the head of the parade. As he moved along Canal Street, he surveyed a crowd composed of blacks and whites alike, a sight unprecedented in New Orleans, and one that alarmed Louis as much as it pleased him. He thought he saw familiar faces in the crowd, boyhood friends now grown up, adults from his youth now grown old, maybe even Irene, one of his first loves, or someone who looked like her. All of a sudden, two faces stood out with clarity, Captain Jones and Peter Davis. Still in command of the Waif's home and its marching band, the two men had come out to greet the most renowned pupil
awesome.
Ever to have survived that regiment. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
Louis promised them he would visit, and the parade into his past continued as he caught glimpses of Parish Prison, the Fisk School, and the church that had superseded Funky Butt Hall. When they reached the Astoria Hotel, he had a brief reunion with his razor-wielding first wife, Daley Parker, and continued to move through crowds of people and policemen, one of whom shook his hand. After the bands finally broke up, he and Alpha went to his hotel room to reflect on the day's momentous events. All in all, said Lewis, I think that day was the happiest day in my life. Here's a track called That's My Home.
When the sun set in the sky, flowers never die, babe. Friends don't pass you by.
But that's my home.
When the folks say how do you do, like they mean it too. When mama's love is true, 'cause that's my home. I'm always welcome by, no matter where I roam.
Home is
just a little shack to me is home sweet home. Where the Swanee River flows, the shady pine tree grows. I needn't say no more, 'cause that's my home.
Well, as wonderful as that was, and even though Lewis did say that that might have been the happiest day of his entire life, the fact was that his experience in New Orleans ultimately was so unsettling enough to make him feel uncomfortable about returning to the city again in the long run. Because like I said, there might have been an upside, but there was a downside as well. And here's that aspect of it. Again, reading from the exact same book by Lawrence Berggren. Without warning, the American Federation of Musicians expelled the members of Armstrong's orchestra from its ranks for, quote, continuing to play with Armstrong after he had been expelled for not fulfilling a contract with a New York nightclub. Connie's in. They got his license revoked as a musician.
Wow.
Lewis and the other members of the band immediately realized that Tommy Rockwell, who was subverting Lewis's New Orleans engagement in order to gain revenge on Johnny Collins, was behind the union's peculiar behavior.
Mm-hmm.
If Rockwell thought he could win his prize trumpeter back with threats and intimidation, he was mistaken. The orchestra had nothing to gain from the union, and Lewis was determined to perform in any event. So the situation, unfortunately, became even uglier. We were called down to the local union and questioned. We called Preston Jackson, a member of his band, who was in Lewis's New Orleans band. There wasn't anything to be done about it. But then they's making an announcement over the air about the quote-unquote, you know the word, for Negroes that they use in the South, coming down to New Orleans and taking the white musicians' jobs. Wherever Lewis's band went after that, they were shadowed by a car bearing four strange and grim-looking white men. Lewis refused to be intimidated. He and his band intended to play their engagement at the Suburban Gardens as planned, the first black orchestra to do so, ever. Opening night came and the place was packed. All of New Orleans high society was there. When it was time to introduce Louis Armstrong and his orchestra, the white announcer refused. "I ain't going to announce that." And there's that word again. "Man," he angrily declared. Collins, his manager, appeared at Louis's side, explaining what had just occurred. Louis's reaction was instantaneous. I turned to the boys on the bandstand and said, "Give me a chord. I got an ear-splitting chord and announced the show myself." It was the first time a Negro spoke on the radio in Louisiana. Huh. There were many ways to signify, and Louis Armstrong had just found a new one. Amid the poison of racial animosity, Louis Armstrong managed to make good music and even enjoy himself. After that night, he was a hero to blacks and even to some whites in New Orleans, and they filled the Suburban Gardens to hear the native son they knew from recordings in newspapers. Well, I guess that's just about it. Here's a track, I guess, to reflect some of the bad side of what Lewis was going through, a track that he actually was responsible for writing himself. From the song, again, from 1932, here's Louis Armstrong singing, "Hobo, You Can't Ride This Train." Take care, everybody. Look forward to seeing you next Friday as we continue with part 10 in our series on Louis Armstrong.
Bye-bye.
Boy, listen at that rhythm train. I bet all the hobos in the world on that train. Even that guy number one there. You remember when he number one? Yeah, I'm the brakesman too. You know, I'm gonna put all them cats off this train.
Yeah, man, yeah, man.
All aboard for Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh. Hattiesburg. All aboard. Get off this train, hobo. I'm off a man, I'm telling you. You got to give me something, boy. Look at you. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, man. Yeah. Yeah, man. Oh, boy, you can't ride this train.
As I said before, hobo. Hobo. You know you can't ride this train. Oh, 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 oh,
I'll give you a break. You're all right, dude.